last week, and it has he's written five or six books, and this is this cuts to the heart of the matter in a very, very positive way. And it's an easy to read. It's very simple. And for those of you in business, it gets right to the heart of what's most important in business. So if you haven't, well, I urge everybody to go out and buy a book. It's a great read. It's fast, and it's really focuses on the things that are most important. So with that, I'll turn it over to our hostess, Mary Fink. Mary?
Thanks, Joe. And I read the book as well last week, and I think it's one of my favorites ever. So I ditto what Joe said. If you're looking for a great leadership book to read, this is the one to have. And there's so many things in there that are just common sense, as we like to say, not commonly practiced. We know it. We've heard it a dozen times before, so why don't we practice it?
Well, yeah, and I think the thing that's been interesting to me is how people have responded to it when, as I said to both of you before the call, there are not a lot of brand new ideas in here. As a matter of fact, this book is kind of a reaction, you know, particularly during the recession. People in my business, the business of writing books and consulting and speaking, I saw so much about wow factors and what can we do extra that can help generate some business, to the point that I started noticing that all these companies that were chasing wow factors were losing on the fundamentals. And so this book is a little bit of a rant in response to everybody going out looking for the next knock your socks off factor, when to me the biggest wow factor is this: wow, you guys get it right every time.
Yeah.
And there's your wow factor right there. So it really is kind of a call for simplicity and clarity and focus, I guess.
I like the way you say things. And one of the comments that I read over and over in the book, that's how I knew it was important, was be so good at the basics that you're cutting edge. It's like there's nothing new in the world, but it is, because taking care of the basics is sort of new today.
You know, the company I use when I speak, and also in the book that I use as an example for that, is Zappos. Mm-hmm. And there are zillions of Zappos fans out there. And when I ask people, what is Zappos good at? What do they do extremely well? They say, well, their shipping is unbelievable, and they've got great selection, and you can return shoes anytime within a year, and they pay the shipping, and their customer service line is just incredible. And I say, well, okay, let's review. They're good at inventory, shipping, customer service, and returns. How much more inside the box than that can you get? But they are so good at it that they're cutting edge.
They are.
And yeah, that's one of my favorite things in the book. When I wrote it, I thought, okay, that might be pretty good.
I think it is good. And I remember being on the phone with one of their order takers before I got online with them, and it was almost like talking to family. You know, they're so friendly, and they're so engaging with you. Mm-hmm. And if you have a problem and you call them, it's like, oh, my gosh, what can we do to fix this for you? And they just stay on it till they have it right.
Well, again, it's one of those, well, okay, Joe, what's a silver bullet for us? Well, why don't you try being really, really good to your customers? that might work.
Well, that's not exciting. I don't want to do that.
Well,
what else you got?
Here's the thing. I think the thing that keeps a lot of people, going back to your original question, why don't we do these things, it's tough. It's hard. It's easier to try and chase a quote-unquote silver bullet, try and find a gimmick that's going to fix things, but there aren't any. There aren't any.
Exactly.
If you win on the basics, you win.
No question.
You know, when I think back about, so as I was reading the book, I was thinking back to my many years at Tractor Supply and what matters most there. And one of the interesting stories we ran into over and over again is people would make their stores look really, really pretty. And they were very proud of making their stores look pretty. But you know what? A pretty store or a not so pretty store doesn't make a darn bit of difference. It's about having the right staff. The right staff, having the right people there with the right attitude. Second, it's about having the right product selection. And third, it's about being in stock. And if you do those three things right, you don't care what the store looks like, as long as it's not a disaster, and you'll just do well. I remember one of the things that was very important to me, as is important to customers, is we had a never-out list of 40 or 50 items in the store that you never want to be out of. You know, if your customers are feeding their horses and they come in for horse feed and you don't have the horse feed, you're about to lose that customer and may never come back. So those are things you want to always be in stock in. And we just tried to focus on hire the right people, make sure we got the right selection in the store, and stay in stock on what's really important. can't stay in stock on everything in a retail store, but you can stay in stock on the top 40 or 50 items that customers depend on you for.
One of the ways, because people say, well, okay, how do we determine what matters most? I think it's two sides of a coin. One side, I think, is what matters most internally in terms of values. What do we believe in? How do we want to do business? How do we treat people, including each other, partners, vendors? And the other side of the coin is the customer side. What are the three or four things that are most important to your customers? Just the three or four things that you absolutely have to get right every time. Well, if you focus on those and if you win on those, you win. I mean, you look at the marketplace, and to me, the evidence is overwhelming that the companies that sustain success are the ones that win on the fundamentals.
I think it's important to know who your customer is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got in our case, we have lots and lots of people coming through the door. We define the customer. We know who our customer is, and we market it to that person. It was a hobby farmer, had an acre or more of land, drove a pickup truck, had dogs and cats, probably had some other animals, typically a family unit, mother, father, and children. And that's who we focused on. We knew that customer inside and out. And when you know your customer inside and out, you can provide the services or goods that the customer is looking for.
I think it's just as important to determine what are the things that we don't want to do. What are the businesses that we do not need to be in?
Right.
And who are the customers that there's somebody else's customer? They're not our sweet spot. We turn down jobs. It's not unusual. Simply because we say, we could do that, but that's not what we do. Let me refer you to somebody else that they'd be a better fit.
I worked on pursuing that exact subject at Tractor Supply for years and years and years because people would say, we can sell this, we can sell this. I remember one time we had toasters in the store. We could get off track very easily, but I used to say, don't dabble. If you're going to be in a business, be in it and be in it right, and of course make sure it's right for our customer. But it's easy in retailing. You got to buy a few of this and buy a few of that and buy a few of the next thing. Before you know it, you look like a variety store instead of a specialty store.
That's exactly right. And the other thing about customers is you don't know until you ask them. I mean, you knew them because you lived with them every single day. But to think you know what a customer wants and go on the basis of that is often so wrong. It gets you off the track.
Stay close to your customer always. Spend lots of time with the customer. We spent half my life was spent on the road visiting stores and taking people with me so that all the buyers went out there, a lot of the staff people, the executives were always in the store, listening to our people who listen to the customers and sometimes listening to the customers directly.
I was working with an international, big international company a couple of years ago, and they had had an experience where they said, we're going to really focus on the top two or three things our customers want, and we know that number one is price. Well, then they went out and did a really in-depth, what's important to you? What was most important to their customers across the board was problem solving. So we get a lot of different parts from you guys, and there's a lot of occasions where a mistake needs to be corrected or we made a mistake, and the speed at which you correct that mistake and the accuracy, that's most important to us. And that wasn't even on their list originally.
Right.
So they had to
find
out.
How do you know?
That's right.
If you don't ask. You don't. So you talk a little bit, and you mentioned a bit before on being the best inside the box. I know a lot of people are looking to do something outside the box or push the envelope, but inside the box is really where it's at, is it not?
Well, and I use that phrase, win inside the box, because it gets people's attention. They say, well, aren't you supposed to think outside the box? Well, if you're talking about innovation and improvement, nobody's a bigger fan, and I talk about that all the way through the book. You have to innovate constantly, and you have to improve constantly, but where will you get the greatest return on improvement and the greatest return on innovation? And that goes back to, well, all right, what is most important to our customers? That doesn't mean you don't develop new products, you don't develop new services, but it's got to be, as Joe was saying a few minutes ago, it's got to be within that sweet spot that this is what we do.
Exactly.
It being the best that I was interesting. I was on a plane this morning. I was reading an article about a very famous group of restaurants in New Orleans called the Brennan Family Restaurants, and it's the Ralph Brennan, the CEO there, is talking about the Brennan Family Restaurants have been around for 60 years. It's people, 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 people. He's in the service business, and it's all about the quality of the people he has and the people's attitude. And that he talks about that. It's a two-page article, and I'll bet you he brings that topic up five times in those two pages. It's all about what matters most to him is the quality of the people in the restaurants, and he talks about that repeatedly.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's the sign of a great leader. And I used to tease you, Joe, years ago when I was doing work with you guys at Tractor Supply. I would say, you know, Joe gets on stage, and the people in the back of the room look at each other and roll their eyes and say, oh, gee, I wonder what Joe's going to talk about. Well, everybody knew what Joe was going to talk about. It's the same things he always talked about. Not that you guys weren't innovative, because you were. You innovated all the time. But you always brought it back to, remember, this, this, and this. And it kept everybody on the same page. It kept everybody focused.
And they still do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's how they've been continued to be successful.
Which leads to our next comment, and that is consistency is the great brand builder. You know, if I'm on the road, I might stop at McDonald's, not because it has the best food, but I know it's going to be very consistent. I know the coffee is going to be the same, every single one. I know there are other things that are going to be the same, and there are other companies that I feel the same way about.
Well, when you have multiple locations, I mean, that's essential, because if you have a bad experience in one restaurant, it's even more difficult than stores. You have a bad experience in one restaurant, you're translating that into every restaurant with that brand on it. So consistency is extremely important at any multiple location.
And I've said, and we've all had experience with a place where we do business, that if there were really truth in advertising, they'd have to hang a sign over their front door that said, feel lucky? Come on in. You know, depends on who you get. It's funny. I heard somebody at a meeting once talk about a grocery store where they said there was this one cashier that was so great that there would be four cashiers on duty, and there would be a line all the way down the store to go to this one cashier. And I said, wait a minute, and you're touting that as a success story, that you've only got one out of five people up front that anybody wants to go to? There's something out of whack. I mean, good for the popular cashier, but come
spread
on.
The wealth.
Yeah, spread the wealth around.
As a little bit of humor, as a retail executive, if I saw that going on, I would think that cashier is giving discounts. They're not supposed to give that.
There's something going on.
Well, you talked about the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. And I remember years ago in classes that I did talking about that very thing and talking about it in terms of Southwest Airlines and how they had figured out that the main thing for them was having planes in the air with people on them, not empty planes, not planes sitting on the ground. And that drove their insistence on all the things that they're so good at and are known for.
I love that you bring Southwest up. That in the last 10 years, there's been a Southwest frenzy. I, among many other authors and speakers and consultants, talk about Southwest a lot. But most of what you hear about Southwest is there'll be somebody at a meeting and they'll show you a video of the singing flight attendants. And they'll say, that's what you need to aspire to. I wrote a blog a couple of days ago that said, if you're aspiring to singing flight attendants, you might ought to peel that back and look at why people fly Southwest, because we've been doing a running survey for 6 years. People fly Southwest for three reasons. Number one, value. Number two, consistency and reliability. Get there on time, the baggage accuracy, all that. And number three, easy to do business with. Mm-hmm. And the singing flight attendants are the cherry on top, and I'm all for that. Nobody loves a singing flight attendant more than me. But people get off track, and they forget that what built Southwest and keeps them in a profit-making position today is their excellence on those fundamentals. And the other stuff is fun, and it's great, and do it, but not until you get the fundamentals right first.
Yeah, I fly Southwest all the time, and it's so interesting when that Southwest plane pulls up to a gate, they execute and get that door open faster than any other airline.
Yeah.
They turn that plane around faster. And the others can't do that. And I always know that even if Southwest plane is delayed, I know I'm going to get there. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other airlines, if a plane's delayed, you don't know you're going to get there, and you begin to look for alternatives because you know there's a high likelihood they'll cancel a flight or something
right.
like that.
And then we go back to what you said a few minutes ago, consistency of performance is the great brand builder, and inconsistency is the great brand killer.
Exactly. So in your experience, would you say that most people in companies, and I'm not talking about senior leadership, but I'm talking about the people on the floor, the people behind the desk or in the cube or whatever, would know what their company's main thing is? How many people really spend some time thinking about that?
Well, it depends on the effectiveness of senior leadership. I've got a good friend that I've actually done consulting with as a partner. Chuck Phelps, who used to be the president of Deluxe Financial Services. He had 20,000 employees. And he said, you know, the senior leadership would spend 6 months or a year on an initiative or rolling out a project or something. And we had it. It was in our bones by the time we quit talking about it. And then we'd go on the road and do a 15 PowerPoint presentation to all the employees and think, well, now they've got it too. And the senior leadership had been living with it day in and day out. And yet they roll it out, as he said, like in a PowerPoint, mm-hmm. and think our job is done. Now all 20,000 people have it. But it goes back to I've never seen an effective senior leader that didn't repeat and reemphasize and just re-drive home what's important all the time. I mean, again, Joe, I quoted you in a book where you said we talk about this stuff all the time, and that's the key.
It's about the culture.
It's all culture.
When you have a culture of repeating the few things that are important over and over and over again, Tractor Supply, we have a mission and value card. And it's on the walls. It's everywhere in the company, but we talk about it all the time. We have these cards we carry around with them. We give them out to other people. We're proud of our culture. We talk about it. And Tractor Supply, no matter what your title was, if you were in a leadership role, you had a secondary title underneath that title called the Minister of Culture for your business unit. So we kept pushing that thing down and kept talking about it over and over and over again. Repetition in leadership is a tremendous value and not understood well enough by an awful lot of leaders.
I agree.
You can't expect the experts tell you you can remember 10% of what you hear a week later. Well, that means if you want to really get something through, you ought to have to say it 10 times. So repetition is what gets through to people, but repetition about the few things that are really important, not about everything.
I agree. And also in the book, I take a pretty strong stance about culture and people that say, well, I'm not going to play that way, which is if you believe in your culture and you think you've got a good culture, be sure you don't have a lot of employees saying, well, if we believe all this stuff that we put on the walls, what about him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why is
exactly.
he still here? And I take the stance that you invite them into the culture, and if they refuse that invitation, they have to go. You invite them out.
Yeah.
Or you tear it up for everybody.
Exactly.
You know, I just give you an example of repetition exactly on that path. At Tractor Supply, we always said the most important decision you ever make are people decisions. So hiring is the most important thing you're going to do. You hire the right people, you stand a great chance of success. And if you do the opposite, you stand a great chance of failure. And in order to, besides just talking about that, twice a year at sales meetings, we always have classes on hiring and interviewing. And it's not the same class every time, but we're always putting that topic in front of, you know, all now 1,200 managers are hearing classes on that stuff, on that subject twice a year, so they keep learning and keep getting better at the selection and hiring process.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Okay, the next point that we have is work in the business, not on it. And I was intrigued by that because that was the one thing in there that I hadn't heard you say before.
Well, it's interesting. That chapter was 90% of it was written by a guest in the book, Jeff Cornwall. At the Center for Entrepreneurship. He writes a column for the paper here in Nashville, and one caught my attention because it goes against conventional wisdom. You hear consultants say all the time, you're spending too much time in your business. You need to go off and think about it and work on it, not in it. And that's true. But Jeff's point was, particularly if you're starting out, if you're building your business, that he has, you know, young people starting a company come to him and they say, okay, we've been working 6 months on our business cards. How do you like our font? And we think we're going to go vertical. Do you think that's better than horizontal? And Jeff's point was, you know, your business cards, just put your name. It doesn't matter. Go get a customer. Go work in your business and get a customer. And I do think that with all the distractions that we've got from the internet and everything else, it's very tempting to think a little too much when sometimes we need to go back and get a customer or take care of a customer and put our nose to the grindstone.
You're doing the basics right day in and day out is what makes you a success, and focusing on those few things that really, really make a difference. hiring the right, in our case, I'll go back to what I said before, getting the right people in the stores, hiring the right people, making sure your product selection's right, and making sure you're always in stock on the things that count the most. We talk about getting close to the customer. We went out on the road all the time, and I would typically take with me a regional vice president and a couple of staff people from HR or IT or county or someplace else, and we'd spend 3 days in the stores, and we'd be talking to every salesperson, and we'd be listening carefully and listening to what they say. And if you do that over and over and over again, I mean, you get very grounded and you get very close to the customer, and you tend to be able to set the right direction for your business unit and really understand what's going on in the business.
You know, one of the examples I cite in the book, and it came from a cover story that Fortune did last September on Nick Saban at the University of Alabama. And it was what management could learn from Nick Saban. And what he said was, we don't talk a whole lot about winning. What we talk about is the process. Mm-hmm. And every player and every coach getting the process right at every practice and in every game. And if you do that, you don't have to talk about winning. You'll win. And so it was that lesson of, that's just like going to the stores.
Yeah.
It's like, let's get the process right every day, every time.
The winning is the result. It's not the goal.
Yeah. Well, it's,
but it's the result of doing other things right.
Yeah. You don't stand and look at the scoreboard during the game. You play the game.
Exactly.
That's how you win it.
Exactly. Tell me about simplicity being the ultimate sophistication.
Well, yeah. Who's that from? Da Vinci? That was a quote from
yes.
Yep. Somebody way smarter than me. I think the best observation I ever heard about simplicity was an interview that Steve Jobs did with, I believe, Wired magazine, in which he said, simplicity has become my mantra. You have to work really, really hard to get your thinking clean enough to make things simple. But it's worth the work, because if you can make things simple, you can move mountains. And I love that idea. I believe it. I know that particularly over the last few years, again, during the recession years, when I would talk to somebody whose business was struggling, they were very likely to say, Joe, this is a very complicated business. And when I talked to somebody whose business was doing well, they were very likely to say, you know, at the end of the day, this is really a pretty simple business. And I do think that it's not easy to make things. It's a lot easier to make things complicated. And I think great leaders have an ability to help people simplify. Simplify, focus, get clarity. That's a valuable skill.
I remember quite a few years ago, we had the various buying groups in the company sending memos to the store about what to do and what needs to be done. And some people would write things in very clear bullet point form, and other people would go on and write that, you know, forever. And we finally took it all away, and we put it under one person in the store operations area, so that everything that went to the store was very simple. But anything that's going out and writing to the stores is very clear in bullet point form, as short as it could be to get the point across. Therefore, you cut down the amount of reading time at the store level, and you multiply that by hundreds of stores times hundreds of hours a year. You're putting a lot of time back into waiting on customers and doing what really counts. And then I personally can't stand to read long memos, so I got the point. If anybody sent me a memo that's more than a page long, I just delete it and let them know what was deleted. People stop writing long memos.
Yeah, try again.
Yeah.
You know, I think that applies also to particularly companies that are either starting out or going through a rethinking of their vision or their mission or their values. And I've worked with a lot of companies. I've been on the retreats with them where they're trying so hard to make it sound professional and corporate instead of making it meaningful to them. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I take the position, and this will stir some folks up in the book, that you don't necessarily have to have a vision and a mission. You can state it another way.
Right.
The example I love so much, I cited it twice, was the ad agency I read about 25 years ago that I don't even remember the name of them, but they had four rules. It was do great work, make money, have fun, don't work with people you can't stand.
Right.
I love that. Now, to a lot of companies, that would not be a good set of rules to go by. But to those guys, it resonated. They knew what it meant. They got it intellectually. They got it emotionally. That's fine.
Right.
You know, people say, but does that sound professional? Listen, if it works, that's professional. If it doesn't work, that to me is unprofessional.
Yeah. no matter how fancy.
No, no matter how fancy.
I did have a moment when I read that you said, you know, you really don't have to have one. It's like sacrilege.
But you know what? One of the case studies in there, actually a friend of mine, Grunder Landscaping, I mean, he runs his classic of businesses you've ever seen. He's got a vision, a mission. He works hard at, I mean, he really takes a classic approach, and he makes it work. And part of the reason is, Joe, he reinforces everything all the time with his people.
That resonated well with
yeah, I thought it would. Yeah, he's a smart guy.
You know, in our business, again, to go back to that, you know, the customer is all important, and the customer, you have a window of opportunity when the customer's in the store to take care of the customer. So you've got to have 100% focus on that customer and the heck with everything else. You know, if the truck shows up the back door, the truck can wait while we take care of the customers. And I used to spend a fair amount of time from time to time calling stores and patting them on the back for big sales increases or success stories or something like that. But I'd always start off the call with, are you busy? And they'd say, yes. I'd say, fine, I'll call you back later, or you call me back later. And they got to know that if the CEO calls or anybody else calls, the customer comes first, and we'll take care of the customer. Everything else can wait. That's clarity. That's a clear focus on what's really important.
Yeah.
And living it out. It's not saying it's actually modeling it. Well, our last point is that your culture is the real-life, everyday version of your values being played out among your people.
Yeah, culture is it's how you act.
Everything.
It's how you behave. It is everything. And I've used the term many, many times, culture drives results. I first started learning about culture really with you guys, Joe, decades ago when I first did some work with Tractor Supply, and I saw how important the way we think and how we treat people and what we value and ethics, integrity, all of that, that truly is the foundation. And I've maintained if you don't get that part right, if you don't get the culture part right, I don't care what you do, it's probably not going to work. Or you're going to be, you know, pushing a boulder uphill if your culture's not right.
Exactly
it's
right.
Just so incredibly key.
It's practicing what you say.
Yeah.
If you mentioned ethics before, Tractor Supply is a very ethical company, and it's not just on paper, it's not just talked about, it's practiced. If somebody's doing something unethical, they're disciplined or fired. There's no backing down from that, no matter what level you're at. You're the newest part-timer or vice president. Everybody marches to the beat of the same drummer.
I use an example in the book, a company in the Midwest, and it wasn't really an ethical question, but it was a culture question. And they were really going to formalize their culture for the first time. Have a big company meeting, and the week before the meeting, the CEO fired number one, their biggest client. He said, if we believe in this culture, then it's just not appropriate for us to do business with them. And he fired his CFO, because the CFO said, you guys can hold hands and sing Kumbaya and all that stuff. I'm not changing. He said, if you're not changing, you can't stay. And morale skyrocketed, and they replaced the business. He made a very important statement about, we're not kidding around. We mean
this.
We're
serious about
it. Yeah, we're serious about it.
You know, there's another book out there. Yes, there is another book out there.
No.
and they talk about the distinction between smart companies and healthy companies.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about smart companies being the ones that put all the focus on finances and strategy and all that. And the healthy companies are the ones, I think there are 5 points, and one is get your team right. All the rest of the points are about clarity. They're about understanding who you are and what you are and how you do what you do, and making sure that there's nobody that doesn't get that.
You know, one of my favorite things about this book is I told you guys for the first time I put questions at the end of each chapter, and they are meant to be discussion questions for the team to get together. And we've already gotten a lot of feedback that it's like, wow, we were not on the same page, and we didn't realize it until we went through some of these questions. And so it's so powerful to do that, because you make assumptions that, well, we all know what's important here. Well, you might ought to check on that.
Well, we all do, but we all think it's something different.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Right. Well, this has been great. Do you have something to add?
Well, let's open it up for questions now. We've been talking about this for half an hour now. We got a lot of good stuff on the table here. What questions do you have? *7.
Hi, so thank you for all the information. I think that this has been very helpful. From a practical standpoint, how do you streamline all the information that we are immersed in our digital world so that you can focus on the basics? So from a practical level, do you only read certain publications? Do you only respond to certain emails? I know you mentioned the one-page rule of thumb. How do you practically manage that?
Well, in this day and age, it's becoming more and more difficult, but it's a matter of personal discipline. What you're going to allow yourself to be immersed in, and what you're not going to allow yourself to be immersed in, and using the delete button is very important. Getting yourself off distribution lists that you don't want to be on, and just not you don't have to respond to every email that comes in. Hitting that delete button is a very powerful way to get things out of your way. The other side of that coin is, though, you do want to get information, so you got to be selective about what you're getting. For example, one of the things that I coach people to do is get, no matter what business you're in, subscribe to either Fortune or Forbes and have it delivered to your house. Once a week you pick it up, or twice a week you pick it up, you're going to find one article in there of interest to you. It's going to help you broaden your career. Try and get, in terms of building your own knowledge base, try to get a little bit outside of your own business. We tend to be, some of us, inundated with trade journals. Well, you don't have to read every trade journal. You don't have to just skim the index. If you don't like anything in there, toss it out. But it's really a matter of personal discipline. You've got to take charge of the world around you and not get inundated by all the things coming at us. And believe me, I know how much is coming at us. It's overwhelming sometimes.
Yeah, let me echo one thing about the looking outside your own industry. I think for most people, I truly believe this, your next best idea is probably way over there somewhere in an area where you may not be looking. So I also agree that paying attention to Forbes and Fortune, one of those, is a good thing to do. You know, another approach is to look at it in terms of time allocation and say, I'm going to reserve late afternoon or whatever time would work for you. It might be first thing in the morning. For me, I grew up on a dairy farm, and I can't shake it. I get up at 4:30 every morning. And from 4:30 to 6, I do a lot of reading. I'm on the Internet looking at the news, business news. I'm looking at corporate websites that interest me. And I do a lot of that before the working day starts. That's a luxury that I get to have. But, yeah, I think you have to filter, and it is a matter of discipline.
I might also add, this isn't exactly helping in the question you asked, but I think it's very important, this whole topic of how you learn. Networking is another very important way to learn, and it's so easy for us all to, you know, go to lunch with the same people every day or brown bag it at the desk, when in fact, you know, a couple of times a week you ought to make it a point to have lunch with somebody you don't usually have lunch with and get to talk about topics you don't usually talk about. That's where the innovative ideas will come from, and that's where you're more likely to learn how to manage the overwhelming amount of information that's coming at you. Plus, you're going to get some bright ideas about how to be a better leader. Thank you very much for that question. Next question.
This is Jim Thien. I want to ask, when you're merging with another company and you're trying to change their culture, do you have a suggestion on what's the easiest way or less offensive way to change that culture?
Let me jump in just as a preface to Joe, because Joe's been there and done that, and I have actually cited your approach as, I think, a great way to do it, because I do think you really had in mind what mattered most. So I
think you have to, whatever way is comfortable for you, you have to impose your culture on the company you're acquiring. You can't go down the path with two different cultures. You got to have one. And the question is, how do you get that culture across? How do you communicate it? But you have to do it. You can't allow things to be separate, because you'll have an eroded morale and you won't have cooperation. At Tractor Supply, in the one big acquisition we did, we took over 100 stores. We hired back many of the people that were in those stores. We closed them down. We put in our merchandise. We put in our systems. And then the president, the senior vice president in charge of operations, and myself, each of us took 30 stores and visited those 30 stores and spent almost a whole day there, including a couple of hours in roundtable discussions with every employee there, and let them know, here's the history of the company, here's what we believe in, here's what's important. And so they got to, every employee in that 100-store acquisition got to know one of the three senior executives in the company and learn all about our history and culture. And the bottom line is it rolled together very nicely. And we never had a cultural rift based on the way we did that.
Yeah, the successful mergers and acquisitions from a culture standpoint that I've seen, it you have to have the most senior leadership go in and talk about the approach is kind of before we talk about what your job's going to be, let's talk about who we are and what's important here. That's the starting point, and that you get clarity on that, you get focus on that, and you get buy-in on that. And not everybody's going to buy in, and that's okay. Then you can be helpful in finding another place where they will buy in.
You can't run a successful organization with somebody who doesn't believe in the culture, particularly at a leadership role. They've got to buy in, or they've got to go away.
Thank you.
We have one online question. Our greater organization believes that all customer service is created equal. Our company believes that it's a key differentiator in an increasingly competitive marketplace. Because our sales teams all work together, how can we convince these other divisions of the necessity of superior service?
Well, let me tell you my very general approach to when you're trying to sell an idea. Rather than take the stance, we are right, and you are wrong, I always say, let the market make your case and say, I'm not interested in being right or wrong. I'm interested in what works. And I think I can make a case that this, in fact, is what works. And here's my evidence to back that up. I mean, that's what I do when I write a book, when I give a speech, when I'm consulting. It's like, you know, very little of this is my opinion. I'm a reporter, and I'm reporting what is working in the marketplace. And I think that when you've got conflicting approaches within an organization, that I think that's the way you sell it, Joe.
The facts sell it. I don't have a particular example to go with that in terms of culture, but in terms of product selection, some people say, "Oh, we shouldn't be selling this," or "our customer really doesn't want this." Well, let's look at the numbers. What are you selling?
Yeah.
You know, if it's a core product and the customers are buying it, we want to carry it. We have particular difficulty with we had carried a lot of old farm parts for a long time, and some of our older store managers who had been in the business for a long time, they were just married to these old farm parts. But the fact of the matter is, they weren't selling, and therefore we went out of those businesses. So letting the numbers make your case is the best way to do it.
Yeah,
so if your division is providing superior service, your results should reflect that, and that becomes the selling point to the other divisions. Thank you. Next question. Star 7.
Hi, my name's Sam. I wanted to ask a quick question about the idea that I think is fascinating, being the best inside the box, or more accurately, as you cleared up, when inside the box. I think from the perspective of someone in a non-leadership role, when they're trying to advance their career, it's easy to get in the mindset of trying to swing for the fences, as it were, trying to work almost exclusively outside the box so you can really hit that home run to advance your career. Can you talk a little bit about some general approaches from the perspective of someone in a leadership role, some general approaches to incentivize excellence inside the box? And maybe another way to think about it is there such a thing as inside the box innovation and creativity, or is that a contradiction in terms? Thank you.
Let me take on your last part of your question first, Sam, and then I'll let Joe talk about incentivization because he's knows way more about it than I do from practical experience. The point that I make is that you have to, and I talk about this all the way through the book, and the idea of what matters most, particularly to customers, is a moving target. I mean, that's all, that bar is going to be raised all the time. And so you have to constantly improve, and you have to innovate. And thinking outside, the way I say it is you want to think outside the box, meaning innovate, in order to win at what matters most to the customer. In other words, if you're innovating just for the sake of innovating, then what's the point? One of the examples I use in the book is I heard a consultant talk about Barney's and how Barney's New York was the way of the future in retailing and that Nordstrom's was dead, except that Barney's last fall, according to the Wall Street Journal, was flirting with bankruptcy, and Nordstrom's has had one of their best quarters in years. And people say, yeah, but Barney's is cool. Yeah, you know what's really cool? Making a profit. That's what's cool to me. And so, yeah, I keep coming back to this idea of innovate constantly so that you can win at what matters most, understanding that from the customer perspective, that's always going to change. That's going to evolve. And as far as incentivizing behavior.
I'll tell you a story, and then I'll give you a suggestion. At Tractor Supply, the incentive is in the store. The store has a monthly sales goal. They make the sales goal, we put so much money in the pot, and everybody splits it up based on how their pay relates to the total store payroll. So that's a financial incentive, that's a team financial incentive every month. So you're dealing with hourly people, you're giving them a quick payoff for their efforts, and it works very well. It's a great incentive. Now, in every business has different financial constraints and different financial measures and so on, so I couldn't talk about what sort of a financial system you should have, incentive system, but financial incentives really need to be carefully put together because they often wind up not producing the results you expect. And it's easy to get sidetracked on those things and create sometimes a reverse effect. Now, the number one motivator of people is recognition. When you have a success, celebrate it. And the more you celebrate a success, the more you're going to have more of those same successes. That's what motivates people.
Hey, Sam, there's a chapter in the book about a company called Bites of Knowledge. I think it's chapter 14, and it opens up by saying, I have an imaginary questioner saying, okay, I get all this, but give me a concrete example of a company that does all this and show me exactly how they do it step by step. And that's exactly what that chapter does. Not that what Bites of Knowledge does is what you should do, but it will show you the manifestation of all of these ideas in terms of how they actually run the business and incentivize their people.
Thank you.
Star 7.
Next question, please.
I have a question from a workplace standpoint. It's, as has already been discussed, very popular to have new innovative ideas, but as someone who is recommending to an executive that we focus on the core, that's not necessarily going to be a popular suggestion. What ways do you suggest getting around that?
I'm not. Say the question again. I want to be sure. I think you've got a great question. I want to be sure I understand it. Just say it one more time so I'm clear.
Sure. So from a standpoint of working within a business that's focused on innovation and as you mentioned, when you have a company that's quote overreaching and losing touch with customers on just the very basics that make the business run. Well, how do you communicate that to an executive in an effective way?
I think we go back to what we said before, or at least this is my take on it, and I'd love to hear what Joe says. I think you make a case, and the results and the numbers make your case. You say, look, here's what we're doing. Here's where we appear to be suffering from that. I really do think you have to build a case where the market – basically makes it for you. You know, the other thing you can do is introduce, and I do this all the time. I'll say, here's what I think, and here's what some people that I think are probably way smarter than me think, and they think the same thing. I agree with them. So I'm not making the case alone. I've got some credibility backing me up, Joe.
You're in a tough situation,
yeah.
Because I don't know who your boss is, and some bosses are very open to hearing the truth, and others are not. So the best way to communicate it is obviously at the right time, in the least threatening way with the most facts, and you may or may not be the right person to do that. So you may want to work with somebody else. It's a tough thing when the boss is so busy doing what he thinks is right or she thinks is right, and it's not producing results. The boss needs to hear the truth, but it has to be handled in a way that it depends. A lot has to do with the personalities involved here. You got to folks with big egos. It's difficult to get that point across. So you need to do it. You need to pick the right time, and get as many facts as you can. Difficult situation. If you want me to talk to him, I will. Just kidding. Next question, please. Thank you very much. Next question, please. That's a tough situation.
It is.
Well, in that case, we want to thank you all very much for joining us today. Remember now, two things. May 9th, mark your calendars, professional image, a much more important topic than you may think it is. And second, if you enjoyed the conversation today, or just on general principles, you ought to go out and buy the best of what matters most.
Be
the best of what matters most. Joe Calloway is the author. Joe, thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure, always.
And we'll see you next month. Thank you. Thanks, Mary.
Uh-huh.